Hey, it's Jordan. All this week leading up to International Women's Day, we're bringing you stories of amazing women, issues of equality and sexism, and discussions we really need to be having. Except I'm not leading them. So please enjoy the work of my amazing colleagues, and I'll be back next week.
Who is Jodie Wilson-Raybould? You've heard her name in the news for going on a month now. She's the woman at the center of the biggest political scandal to hit Canada in a very long time.
The Trudeau government finding itself in crisis mode over this SNC-Lavalin scandal. Bombshell testimony on Wednesday from Canada's former Attorney General, Jodie Wilson-Raybould.
Hers is a name Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will never, ever forget. The Right Honourable Jodie Wilson-Raybould testified that she would not bend to what she considered inappropriate pressure on the part of his office to interfere in the SNC-Lavalin case, and that she was ultimately penalized for it.
The Prime Minister asked me to help out, to find a solution here for SNC. In response, I explained to him the law.
But Jodie Wilson-Raybould is also a person, an Indigenous lawyer with a whole life and distinguished career prior to these headlines. The Liberal MP for Vancouver Granville fielded all that pressure back when she was still the first Indigenous woman to become Attorney General, a star member of Trudeau's gender-balanced cabinet before being shuffled to Veterans Affairs as a result, she believes, of standing her ground, defending the rule of law. Canadians have mostly lauded Wilson-Raybould for, quote, speaking her truth to power. But that doesn't mean she hasn't been subject to racism and sexism, allegedly from even within her own party. But why? Where's this all coming from? And what does this kind of treatment say about the Liberal Party, or more broadly, Canadian politics? I'm Sarah Bosfeld, in for Jordan Heath Rawlings, as we mark International Women's Day this week. This is The Big Story. To walk us through who Wilson-Raybould is, how she's been treated, and the significance of how she's been treated, we welcome Globe and Mail columnist Elizabeth Renzetti to The Big Story podcast. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Sarah.
Thanks for coming on.
Happy to be here.
Well, tell me a little bit about what you know about Wilson-Raybould. She, you know, she's a big deal in Trudeau's gender-balanced cabinet, no longer in cabinet. But what's her sort of backstory? How'd she sort of get here to begin with that you know about?
Well, she was the first Indigenous woman to be Justice Minister and Attorney General. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, she was a lawyer, quite celebrated lawyer in British Columbia, and an Indigenous woman as well. And she, of course, famously was demoted from her position of Justice Minister and Attorney General into Veterans Affairs, widely considered to be a demotion, although, of course, Veterans Affairs is a really important portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What happened after that is what sort of, I think she was fairly well known to the public mm-hmm. eye because of high profile legal and justice issues on the federal landscape, like cannabis legalization, the right to die legislation and things like this. So she'd always been quite high profile. But this particular scandal around SNC-Lavalin has really put her profile in a just in the stratosphere.
Yeah, eye of the storm, really.
Eye of the storm, yeah.
Yeah. So, and the eye of the storm really last week felt like the day that she testified. She's sitting for hours in front of this Justice Committee, you know, and you were watching. How did you feel?
Yeah, it was quite extraordinary. It felt like, you know, one of those moments where the entire country stopped, oddly. Mm-hmm. Everyone I knew had stopped and was sitting somewhere watching this. And it, of course, happened on the same day that Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, was testifying before Congress in the United States. And that was a much more combative and kind of fiery, weird, male, boisterous, angry confrontation. Mm. And then there came Jodie Wilson-Raybould and sat down with no one sitting beside her and her, possibly assistants behind her. And in front of what is, I'm sure, the most packed Justice Committee there has ever been. I'm sure there were people lined up outside. And she testified in the most kind of extraordinary way, like just very calm, very methodical, very meticulous, never sort of giving away any sense that she felt, you know, angry or anything like that. It was just very calm. She laid out what had happened to her. And I think for most people, more persuasive for the kind of calmness with which she laid out her, as she said, her truth.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. You know, it really did land well with a lot of Canadians. And I think She Speaks Her Truth was the headline on the Toronto Star the next day. What do you read into that positive response to the way that she testified? Does she have to do that in order to be credible, to be listened to be heard?
Well, we had had a vacuum around this, right, around this issue for the longest time. The prime minister would say a couple of little things, and then there was, you know, people, you know, briefing off the record and things, and you'd get those versions in the news. But there was no kind of there until she spoke. There was no central narrative until she spoke about what had happened during this. We'd had Michael Warnock, the chief of the clerk of the Privy Council, speaking. But apart from that, sort of none of the central players had spoken. And so I think there was a real hunger to have some kind of sense of, instead of innuendo and slur and background noise, to actually have somebody lay down what they saw to be the kind of accurate series of events according to their point of view, which is what she did.
Yeah, and she had the receipts, right? She had like
she
notes.
Totally had the receipts. She spilled the tea. Yeah,
she spilled the tea on the
receipts. Really did. She had. It seemed to me very lawyerly. You know, she laid things out methodically. She had clearly kept contemporaneous notes. She had emails and texts and things like that. And never in the almost, I think it was 4 hours of testimony, did she divert from this narrative of this is what happened to me and this is how I felt. And she didn't use hyperbolic language or anything, but it was all the more powerful for that, for her just using little tiny phrases like veiled threats. Mm-hmm. And then she made, a reference to Richard Nixon and the Saturday Night Massacre, mm-hmm. you know, in which he needed to get people to do his dastardly bidding, and went down the list in the Department of Justice until he found somebody who would. So these things, I think, were because she spoke so carefully and so directly, it had a real impact. And there was no hyperbole. There was no kind of, you know, Warnock, when he was testifying, was much more passionate and emboldened and kind of forceful, threats to democracy, and, you know, somebody's going to get killed. There's this crazy culture of or aura of partisanship and violence in the in the air, which I think is probably, there's some
true
accuracy
to
that. Yeah, for sure. But her testimony was so different and so much more powerful for it.
Yes, that's her position in all this scandal and controversy. But what do you sort of see when you put a gender lens on that as a woman having to be believed and credible? I think we've seen lots of, obviously in way different contexts, but, you know, lots of testimonies from women who are needing to be, have their side of their version of things heard. And in a lot of ways there, it doesn't get the weight that...
Are you thinking of Christine Blasey
Maybe,
Ford right
yeah,
now?
Maybe. I actually am, yeah.
Christine Blasey Ford, who still has not been able, as far as I know, to move back into her house and is still suffering death threats and has to have, people around her, bodyguards and things.
And so just to be clear, she was the woman who said that as a teen she was sexually assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh, who is now on the Supreme Court bench in the United States.
Yes, exactly. So we do kind of, I think, for better or worse, partly because there are so few women in these very high positions of power. So when they do come forward to testify, for better or worse, they do kind of, you know, the intensity of our gaze is upon them because mm-hmm. they are few and far between. And I don't think you can separate that for Jody Wilson-Raybould, because I don't know if you know this, but Justin Trudeau is a feminist.
Is he?
Yeah, it's true. I know. I thought I should be the first one to tell you this.
Thank you. He's blush.
And he had a gender balanced cabinet mm-hmm. in 2015.
She was a major star player.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. She was a major star player. So I think what's happened is, as I wrote in a column at the time, live by the F word, die by the F word. So he has made such, he has really tied so much of his credibility, I think, to this idea of gender justice, gender equity, the pushing of progressive feminist causes. And I have to say, in many ways, the government has been good. You know, like mm-hmm. there has been terrific legislation in certain ways. But if you're going to present yourself as being purer than pure and more pristine than pristine, then anytime you are seen to step outside that boundary, anytime you are perhaps seen to be treating a senior female member of your cabinet in a way that is not necessarily progressive, or perhaps there are other members of your caucus who are briefing against her or are saying things about her that, frankly, smack of sexism, even off the record, then that's going to look really bad. And I think that's what we saw here.
And also, there had been reports of some really racist and sexist language used against her, you know, within the government, but also out in the world. What have you sort of seen or heard about that?
Oh, yeah, there's been all kinds of things. And we had a couple of liberal backbenchers say things about her along the lines of, you know, she couldn't handle the stress or she wasn't a team player. One said that her father was perhaps pulling her strings, which is just, I know.
Yes.
He later apologized for it, and he apologized good. In the House, which is good. But in a way, I actually find hearing those things oddly refreshing because I know so many people actually think them.
Yes. And congratulations, you said them out loud.
Well, I kind of feel like at least we get to see what people truly feel. And then it becomes obvious and then we can deal with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now, you know, I was actually quite surprised that we did hear things along those lines. What we've heard also, and again, this is more off the record stuff, is, you know, that she was difficult, not a team player.
Difficult can be code, right?
Absolutely. No, there's no doubt about it whatsoever. There's all these coded words that are used for women, mm-hmm. especially women in leadership roles, especially women in politics. And unlikable is a big one, or likable.
Which we hear with Hillary Clinton all the time, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or Elizabeth Warren, or, you know, any of the American politicians, likable, team player, you know, cooperative. And it's interesting because traditionally what women are thought to bring to leadership tables, whether it's the boardroom or political leadership tables, is the so-called soft skills, right? Soft power.
Mm-hmm.
So that is empathy, you know, being a team player, being able to work well with others, collaboration. So I think any woman who then diverts from that script, no matter in how small a way, is branded as perhaps even more harshly than her male colleagues would be.
Mm-hmm. And he kept calling her Jody in the early days,
oh,
which rubbed me the wrong way. It was like, well, Jody, you know, it's going to do this or that. And I'm like, she's, you know, a minister,
Ms.
right?
Wilson
right
Rabel to you.
Yeah. Right, honorable.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, what do you see as really hypocritical on his part then? You know, you really outlined very well, you know, the double standards, I think, for a lot of women who are in powerful roles. Like, why is it an especially bad problem for Justin Trudeau?
Because this has been his entire brand. So last week I interviewed this famous American journalist in Toronto named Rebecca Traister, American feminist journalist. And she was kind of gobsmacked by the whole scandal because she said, when you look from outside our country, what they know about Justin Trudeau is that he's a great feminist and, you know, that he pushes women's equality. And that has been the brand that they built from, you know, from when he was in opposition mm-hmm. and till this day. So, as I say, any kind of little speck of dirt becomes a huge stain. And not only that, what I worry about is that then that leads people who viewed his whole agenda to begin with as nothing more than a branding exercise to take feminist ideals and principles and progressive goals as nothing more than a branding exercise and to say, oh, see, it's all just a sham and not important and it's all just been political gloss.
Makes it easier for everyone, you know.
Yeah, to dismiss it. And that, I think that would be the most harmful outcome of this is just to say, you know, that these things aren't hugely important. They were all just some kind of strange window dressing for the Liberals. And again, I do want to repeat that I think the Liberals have been really good in certain ways. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, they really did dress this up as like there's a little bit too much of, you know, wearing the F word as a crown, I think. Yeah. That word would be feminism.
Can I have an F word crown? But I want to go back to her testimony. You know, she testified that she fielded 10 phone calls, 10 in-person meetings about this. I wondered what you thought about whether there's like a gender dynamic in the wearing down of a person. You know, do you think that a guy would have been, gone back to and gone back to that many times after saying no, after looking the prime minister in the eye and saying no?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I, of course, cannot know the answer to that, but it's a really good question. And would a guy have in the first place maybe just extremely forcefully said, like, shut it down right now? But I think she did. She did. She said that she had said to him in that meeting, you need to stop talking, like, you need to stop talking about this. Like, we need to stop talking about this because it becomes, when he had allegedly mentioned the issue of him being a Quebec MP and the upcoming Quebec election.
She was like, are you asking me to interfere politically? I would strongly advise against that.
I would strongly add my own sass
to that because she probably said it much more, you know.
Sarah's doing hand gestures here, you should know. She's just doing her, I would strongly advise against.
With my finger in the air. But that's what she said, you know.
Yeah. So I do, I cannot know how he behaves with, you know, his male cabinet colleagues. The other interesting thing, of course, is that she was not like a liberal going way back. She wasn't a party partisan. So as one of the columnists in the Globe pointed out, when you recruit from outside the party, you get people whose loyalty is perhaps to their own ethics rather than
or to the law
rather than to the electoral success of the party that they belong to, which, if you ask me, is not a bad thing.
Yeah, and we've seen those examples of sort of stepping outside of the line, and this being the biggest example too. But we also have you know, an MP from, I believe it's Whitby, Selena
Caesar-Chavannes,
who's just said that she's not going to run again. And she, you know, had certain moments where she really stepped out on a limb for, you know, herself. And, you know, in terms of standing up for what she believed in, a Maxime Bernier run-in comes to mind. And, you know, was the PMO cheering her on there? Was she supported?
I don't know what she would say about that, but I don't think, it seemed to me from the outside that she was not supported. So essentially it was over a matter of, you know, she's a Black woman. And I think, I cannot imagine how much more exponentially difficult it is for a woman of color on Parliament Hill to, you know, navigate those corridors of power. And she got in a tiff with Maxime Bernier, who tried to school her ridiculously, her woman from a racialized community, over issues of race. And I don't think that the government supported her nearly as much as they should have. So she's decided not to run again. And this is very interesting to me because the prime minister has talked again and again about how the difficulty around women, attracting women to politics, federal politics, is not so much around recruiting them in the first place, but it's about retaining them. And he said the retention problem is around the nastiness that occurs, whether that nastiness, I think he meant nastiness from, like, you know, opposition or maybe even members of the public, but not him, not from your own party. Yeah. But it seems to me that this case of a very promising one-term Liberal MP who is no longer running in the next election is a very clear issue of a retention problem, as he called it, the challenge around retention. And I very much hope that there's, like, some committee looking at what the problems are of keeping those women beyond one term. We want to have women who, you know, stay on Parliament Hill for, we want them to be like Hazel McCallion.
Yeah.
We want them to be like 90.
Mayor Mississauga, who is mayor for all of eternity.
Yes.
I mean, I'll bet Jody Wilson-Raybould said this week that she is going to run again, and for the Liberals as well. But I do want to just ask you about the full impact of this on Trudeau and his feminism, on the party, on women in politics to begin with. What do women who may be interested in politics see in all of this, and how do they sort of internalize any decisions that they might make about running in the future?
Well, I view it in a hopeful way. I'm a glass half full, whiskey glass half full kind of a person. And I actually think that, and there have been a bunch of stories around how her conduct in this matter has been very encouraging, especially to young Indigenous women. So I think seeing somebody up there, like, unbroken, unbowed, despite an incredible amount of pressure, despite having essentially, really, the governing party coming down on your head, it lets young women know that it might not be an easy job, but it's a job you can do with dignity and to be true to yourself. And that if she can withstand even the worst possible imaginable pressure, then maybe they can do it too. Mm. And, she, you know, she seemed badass. Can I say badass?
You can say badass.
You know, she seemed badass.
And badass.
And
yeah.
I think that's a good, that is like a good model for girls to see.
So this may have been bad for the Trudeau feminism brand, but here emerges, you know, a real role model for young women who might be interested in just getting involved in whatever ways, you know.
Is this the time we talk about how there's not been a female prime minister in this country for 26 years? And even then, there was only one for a very brief
hot second,
and she wasn't even elected. And, you know, she was only brought in, and I think she's I think Kim Campbell is an absolute top rate intellect, and I liked her as a politician. Mm-hmm. And she was really left to hang out to dry by a party that was mortally wounded. So when are we going to see another woman run a federal party in this country? When are we going to see a prime minister?
Maybe it'll be Jody Wilson-Raybould.
Maybe.
I think when she was a kid, she told her dad, who then told a politician in Ottawa that he wants to be prime minister one day.
Maybe we'll see it.
Good campaign start, right?
<Yeah. laughs>
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Elizabeth Ranzetti, columnist for The Globe and Mail. That was The Big Story, celebrating women every day this week ahead of International Women's Day. For more, visit thebigstorypodcast.ca or at thebigstoryfpn on Twitter. I'm Sarah Bosvald. Thanks so much for listening.